You are listening to Bicycle Retail Radio, brought to you by the National Bicycle Dealers Association.
Welcome to another episode of Bicycle Retail Radio, brought to you by the NBDA. I'm Heather Mason. Thank you for listening. I'm so happy you're here. If you're a first-time listener, be sure to check out the previous episodes. Please do us a favor, leave a review. It helps members of our industry find our podcast. And this podcast is designed specifically for the bicycle industry. We are dedicated to strengthening our retailers and cycling community. Today's guest is Amos Brumble, a bike racer, coach, owner of Brumble Bikes in Westerly, Rhode Island, head of operations at Velo Tooler, an all-around super great guy and my personal friend. Welcome, Amos.
Nice to be here.
Amos, we have been friends for many years. When I was thinking about, you know, what I wanted to ask you today, I was thinking about when our friendship began, and I want to say it happened when I was visiting you when I worked for Merck's, right?
Yeah. You came in and you said that my shop had been recommended by a couple places to as a potential good fit for Merck's. So there you were.
Yeah. So your shop is so unique, and we'll get into that with describing that to our listeners. But I was instantly drawn to your shop and you as a person, and that's why I wanted to have you on today. You have a great sense of, and I put into quotes, like the sense of your business. And I asked you in preparing for this to describe what you would say about your unique shop operations. And you said to me that you think of the shop as more of a doctor's office than an all-you-can-eat buffet that's open 24 hours. I love that, Amos. About that.
You know what it is I think the business advice that's always been passed on to me is that, you know, you can't be all things to all people. And I kind of take that to heart. And it basically means, like, you know, like the idea that, like, you could go into like a buffet and the chances are anybody could go in and there'll be something that they'll like. Versus my personal attitude is that there are people that are going to like the things that I'm giving them. And so that's what they're going to get, you know? And then there's going to be a lot of people that are going to be like, I don't like the way you do it. I don't like the products that you sell, you know, a variety of things that are like kind of negative. And I honestly consider that to be positive reinforcement that I'm doing the right thing.
I mean, I think you're definitely doing the right thing. And I really want to explain more to our listeners about the doctor's office feel of Brumble Bikes. Your shop tagline is saving the world one bike at a time. And your business model is so unique. And I think it's definitely one that could inspire a new breed of retail. So yeah, I'm just so excited to just dive in with this. I think too often that we lose sight of taking care of ourselves. And I know that, you know, I know you're a bike racer and you try to get out often and ride, and that you set your business up to still allow you to have that time and do that for yourself. And I think it's so important that we take care of ourselves like that. So we have so much to get into this episode, the norm of your shop hours, your coach, you're the head of operations with Velo Tooler. Everything here is going to be really great. Before we get started, I just want to give a call out to, you might have seen on our social feeds recently, that Bike Exchange is a new partner with the NBDA. Bike Exchange is really unique. I had a call with Steve last week, and they're offering platforms to retailers that allow you to have a broader audience with your old inventory. So if you haven't had a chance to check out Bike Exchange, take a look at the preferred partner page on the NBDA.com website. And he's being so great and offering a discount to the NBDA members. So thanks, Steve and Bike Exchange. Okay, Amos, it's been like a year since we saw each other, right? I mean, a year?
Yeah.
I mean, we keep trying to make the plans, you know, throw the gear in the car, we'll meet up, we'll snowshoe, we'll hike, we'll do whatever. Yeah, it's just too busy, right?
I think, you know, like, obviously I have things set up so that given a little bit of time, you know, and certain days of the week, I know that I can just drop everything and go do something. You know, and that's kind of, I wouldn't say necessarily that I have a lifestyle business, but I have a lifestyle business.
All right. So how did you end up in the bike industry, Amos? What brought you here?
I think what really brought me here was the local shop needed a mechanic. And at that point, I was already tuning up bikes like in my basement. And, you know, they needed somebody to work. And, you know, I was like delivering newspapers and I was, you know, servicing bikes, you know, for people I knew. And he wanted me because he'd heard good things about me. And I think I basically had a question like, you know, why do I want to work here? So that ended up kind of, I worked there for not that long. I got fired. Well, basically what happened was, is that I was working that job. I was delivering newspapers. And then another local shop, Mystic Cycle Center, had opened up. And a friend of mine that I rode with worked there. Or he was one of the managers. And he needed somebody to help build bikes. And I said, okay. You know, and I don't see a conflict of interest. And this will lead into the Velotour thing, but I never saw a conflict of interest. So I was building bikes there. And, you know, they basically said, oh, we can get you like an employee purchase on a Specialized. I said, yeah, sure. Now, the other shop that I'm working at, you know, I was still tuning bikes up at home, delivering newspapers, working at the shop. So I would ride up on all kinds of different bikes when I would go to work. And he'd always ask me, well, whose bike is that? Whose bike is that? Whose bike is that? And then I got the Specialized, and he's like, whose bike is that? I said, oh, it's mine. You know, I bought it. And he was furious about it, you know, and fired me. And I said, okay.
Oh, my gosh, Amos. Yeah.
And then eventually, you know, I stayed, you know, doing the mechanical work on and off for a long time. And eventually an option to manage a shop came up, the first shop where I really started doing the group rides and going to. And then that was sold after a couple of years, and I opened mine in 2004 and been doing it ever since.
So Brumble Bike, so that name comes from your name? Is that, I mean, it's just like, tell us.
You know, I tried other stuff. And from a business perspective, you know, the main concern I had about using my own name is that if I ever came to a point where I was selling it, obviously it's my name. It's the same problem with calling your name. You know, like I could say, it could have said it was Westerly Bikes. I mean, if you open up a location and a second one in the next town over and it's not Westerly, it kind of doesn't make any sense. So I did a lot of back and forth with a business mentor of mine, a guy named Peter Puzzelli, who's actually, he's written multiple books, pretty smart guy. And he just said, you should just use your name. And I said, okay.
Yeah. And I spent some time on your website before, and I had before, you know, when I was working with Merckx and, you know, acting as a sales rep for you, but it fits so well, Brumble Bikes, because the shop is really you. I mean, you're the mechanic, you're the heart and soul in it. So, all right. So tell us about your business idea, like the vision. Give our listeners like an idea of what makes, I'm saying it's so unique and we're calling it, you know, like a doctor's office. Can you tell us about your vision and what makes Brumble Bikes so unique?
I had done like a couple things before I opened it, and it's hard for me to say it's unique because I, you know, a lot of times I'm like, it's the thing that I do every day, so it doesn't feel unique. But you know what? The last shop I had managed before I opened my own, I had basically surveyed all the customers. And I just said, well, what do you want in the shop that I'm currently in, you know, for you? What do the customers want? And they gave like a list of different things that they wanted. And at that shop, it was King Cyclery, we just didn't have the option of actually implementing the things that they wanted. So when I opened mine, I said, okay, well, what do these people want? You know, I know it's been a big trend for shops to have, say, like a coffee bar or out like a beer thing or some other type of business. But when I asked the really enthusiast customers, the ones that were spending the most money, came in the most often, and recommended the business to other people, those people specifically said that they did not want that. They wanted a bike shop that was a bike shop. That's it. Nothing else. So I said, okay. And I knew that meant when it was going to be like bad weather, or, you know, like not the on season, it would be really slow. And when it was busy, it'd be busy. So I kind of built everything around that. And then the other thing I had asked people, I said, well, what do you want to see in the store? And a lot of times it was the stuff to fix their bikes, spare parts. I said, well, I'll invest my money in spare parts. So when people come into my store, like they don't see like, you know, a bunch of bikes. So like that service, my best customer, like goes through every step of the business. Like every area is affected by those decisions.
Yeah. So you set your shop up based on data from the customers that you thought would be shopping you know, with you. That makes total sense. So do you have, when you say you have a specific customer, do you not sell kids bikes or do you not sell mountain bikes or are you only focused on road? Give us an idea of who your general customer is.
General customer is road rider, probably in their 50s to probably in their 70s. And maybe less than 5% of my sales would make up of kids bikes and mountain bike related product. Bike sales are not the biggest portion of the business. They never really have been. If a customer wants to buy a bike from me, I'll get it. With COVID, you know, that part of the model kind of went out the window. So, I mean, I had a year, like probably 3 years ago, I sold one hybrid the entire year.
So what is the biggest portion of your sales then? Is it your service?
Yeah, service and the parts that are kind of related to that service. That's okay. The biggest part.
All right. Your shop is amazing corner location. I love your building. It's definitely very, you know, I've never seen another place like it. So a big question that I've been getting often in conversation with shop owners is renting or owning their location. So I'm wondering, you know, tell us, why are you in your specific location? You know, listeners, he is in this amazing corner spot. It's like a old house, you know, totally Rhode Island look, a feel to it. So Amos, why did you choose that location? And do you rent? Do you own? Tell us a little bit about your spot.
I own the location. One of the things I had looked at is things like traffic counts and where to cyclist ride is another one. And I also wanted a mixed residential commercial building. That way I could live in it. So that would reduce. And so if I stay with the original business plan, when it's slow, it's really slow. So I needed a way to like cut the overhead. And I kind of always liked that idea of the shop owner, like being the shop owner, like they're just there. So, you know, I wanted a mixed residential commercial building. And I had looked at a few, and I mean, initially I didn't have the money to actually do this. I would have never rented ever, but that wasn't an option. I didn't have the finances, you know, to start off by buying a building. So I rented. But the truth be told, like my rent that I was paying at my previous location is actually the same as my mortgage. So I actually bought this building from a person who was a customer. They'd come in my store like a few times and, you know, the husband died. The wife hated the building, hated it with a passion. You know, and basically I had talked to the realtor, you know, I had some people that had given me advice about making an offer on the building. And basically I went back and forth with the realtor, just kind of over the phone, like they gave me the keys to the building and said, here, take the keys, you know, check it out. I brought in the building inspector. I brought in the fire marshal. I brought in zoning. So I brought in all the people from the town to make sure that what I wanted to do was going to be okay, and made the offer, which was accepted. And then I got an SBA loan, which is a special use loan because it's an owner-occupied building. So there's like a special category for that type of loan. And that took 8 months to go through. It took forever. I needed so much help with that. You know, I had a bookkeeper, accountant, lawyer. I'm like, I just want to buy a building, get a loan. And such a production, but it took a while, but eventually it went through.
Yeah. What I hear the consensus is from shop owners is that owning instead of renting is definitely the way to go. I think it probably depends, but that seems to be the consensus that I'm hearing. And yeah, the SBA loan, that's a great point that you brought us up, Amos, like for people who are considering starting a shop, looking at those sources that are available. So I'm sure there's some of our listeners and bike shop owners who are thinking, hours, 12 to 5? Like, how is that feasible? No weekends? I mean, Amos, what? You're Monday through Friday? What? Tell us how you're doing this.
So, I mean, I'll preface this with my shop made a profit year one. So it's always made a profit every year since I opened it. Maybe not a lot, but I've always made money. So one of the things, I've had an electronic point of sale since I opened the store. I have switched point of sale systems from my original one to Lightspeed, but I would use that system to track what time were purchases made and on what days. And actually, a lot of credit card processors will just send you this kind of stuff automatically. So I use Square in the shop as a credit card processor. And they'll tell you, like, here's your peak day. Here's your peak times. But I, you know, well before that, I looked at when people came in. They don't come in the morning. You know, they come in the afternoon. Part of me is like, how do you get people get here at 3 o'clock? I mean, but that's when they were coming. And I said, well, I want to be able to ride my bike. And I need to be able to run the store alone. You know, so everything is based on the idea that I would have no help at all. I do have, you know, 4 employees. So my situation is maybe a little bit different. But I want to say last week, I think out of the 5 days I was here, I think I was alone on 4 of them. So, you know, built around the idea that the store could be run by a single person. So that means I come in early or I stay late or both. It kind of depends. And everybody told me it wouldn't work.
Right. Yeah. People like to tell you it won't work. But when you're looking at data and you're making decisions based on data and also decisions to keep you sane, you know, being the sole person there, sounds like it will work.
I guess it's 16 years in. I'm going to say that it works. You know, I mean, I'm not saying there aren't sacrifices that I've made. I had made a purchase of was to get a large box, one of those bike storage boxes, like a locker. So, you know, my customers can drop a bike off 24 hours a day if they want.
Well, you have a locker outside for your customers to drop off or pick up outside of hours. Amos, that's smart. I love that idea.
Yeah, it'll fit 2 bikes.
Okay.
You know, tell people, I'm like, yeah, you know, put it in there. There's a lock. Throw the key under the door. You know, leave me a message. Bike's in the locker. Okay. You go get it. Do the work.
I actually, when we first met, I was so just intrigued by your shop operations that I, you know how I'm very personal, right? So I told another shop owner friend who, you know, sole proprietor, was there pretty much day, you know, from 10 a.m. to 7 p.m. Monday through Friday and on Saturday at his shop, like the only person. I was like, you should just close on Mondays. He's like, I can't do that. And so I finally convinced him to based on, well, I was like, so let me tell you about my friend Amos, right? and so he did. And a couple of years later, he said it's the best. He didn't lose any business. People just came other days and he's been able to go ride and like reconnect with the sport, you know? So it's really, I like the way that you're saying it's data-based and it's, you know, the way that you've made it work for you. And I think other shop owners could learn from that too and take a look at those hours and fine tune them, you know, where necessary.
Yeah, I mean, and I do a lot of appointments. So if my customers need to come in early or they need to come late, you know, I tell them, I mean, as long as I have a little bit of warning, I can reschedule my day to make it work.
Amos, with COVID this past year, did you have to do anything different at the shop?
No, I actually didn't change anything at all. No, there was no changes.
So what brands do you sell? Are you still carrying Merckx? I think you are, right?
Yeah, still carrying Merckx. Cannondale is really my main line. I mean, right now there's just no product to talk about. Pinarello, Look, Niner. And I want to say when it really comes down to it, if somebody wants a bike and it's like a weird brand, I'll try and get it. My point of view is that if a customer comes in and they're asking about a certain bike, they're already sold. So yeah, maybe I might make a couple more margin points if I sell them a brand that I already deal with. Or I might lose the sale. So, you know, I'll make the inquiries with the brand, you know, see if they want to sell a single bike. And if the answer is yes, and I can make it all work, then I get it for them.
So Amos, I know a few of the brands that you mentioned do e-road bikes. Are you seeing any movement there? Have you sold a few of those?
I sold a couple Pinarellos, the Dioto. I actually sold one of the gravel bike and one of the road bikes. There's a lot of resistance from my customers because I want to say that they want to feel like that the reason that they're willing to buy an e-road bike is because they can't keep up anymore. And so therefore, then they're going to buy it. So a lot of them, it's actually a future purchase, I think, for a lot of people.
Right. Yeah, I agree with that. Do you sell used bikes at all? At the shop, I know a bunch of retailers are thinking about that now with the inventory levels. I didn't know if that's something that you had thought about or offer.
It's kind of off and on. I mean, I've taken trade-ins once in a while, and pretty much all those like got sold last year. But, you know, from a lot of conversations with people that had come into the store, it was really apparent that their threshold for buying a used bike was $200. And basically, because I want to say Walmart is their comparison shopping point, and their bikes are usually going to be around $200. So that was the logic there. Yeah, people just don't want to go past it.
So you said you have that storage locker outside, but I know you have your really cool Rumble van. So you do pickup and delivery, right? Is that something that you do at the shop? Yeah. Are you feeling like this past year with COVID, you did more of that, or did you focus on?
I did do more of that, but I think that one of the reasons was is that some people, they just don't have a wrap to transport the bike. So it wasn't necessarily COVID directly. It was an indirect thing. You know, they started riding again, but they had no way to get the bike here.
Yeah. Yeah, right. They started riding again, but they couldn't get the bike. Yeah, that makes total sense.
Yeah.
Okay, so back to supplier relations. We rode last year and it was amazing. We went on this like night ride with our fat bikes, our Cannondale fat bikes, and it was amazing. How important do you think it is that shop owners ride with their reps? And like, how can we, a big thing right now is communication and how shops can, you know, let their reps know what they need. And you think that riding is important? Any tips for communication for shop and supplier relationships?
Well, I mean, usually the rep is going to be the most direct communication that I'm going to have with whatever brands that I deal with, whether it be an outside rep or an inside rep. So I think the communication thing is like pretty critical. I mean, my preference is, you know, phone calls or emails. And again, very similar to my customers, as long as we can schedule a visit, then I'll make that work. And the stuff I'm looking to be, obviously I want to know about new product, but I'm also looking to know about where the brand itself is going. You know, I know a lot of brands are going to keep future models and direction kind of hush hush, but you know, I kind of need to know like, hey, we're going to phase out that product in 6 months. All right. Well, I should get rid of what I've got, be real careful about buying more of it. And that leads to a better long-term relationship with a brand rather than having, say, no information, buying too much product and then having to discount it like at some future date. I'm like, yeah, I don't want that.
Yeah. You know, I was just thinking it's, you know, too often I think reps, our job, right, or their job is to sell, but that it's also to communicate and to help the shop sell and to be a true partner. And I mean, I feel like when we, you know, riding or going out and grabbing a coffee or whatever allows those conversations to kind of come about that just elevates the partnership, right? And you, it's more than just selling. Oh my God, that ride, Amos, you were so fast. I was barely keeping up with you. But I know it's because you race, right? I think you've been on, is it the CCB team since like 2000, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I enjoy competition.
Yeah, you
do. I don't recommend it. I never recommend it to people. I'm like, yeah, no, don't do it.
You don't recommend racing. But I mean, do you feel like because you do ride and you do race, do you feel like it helps your business?
I mean, I make it help my business. Is what I would say. I think most shops could get away with, you know, there's enough business where the person doesn't care how confident of a cyclist that you are. Just doesn't matter. The fact is you have a bike shop, so therefore you're confident. I think with the products that I sell and the people that I concentrate on, me being able to ride at the level that they're capable of riding at is very important, you know. And, you know, basically, I think a lot of it is that the customers want to aspire to be like the people they deal with when you're dealing with people that are like enthusiast customers.
Yeah. I mean, I would also think that it qualifies you to be extremely knowledgeable on the suggestions that you're giving. You know, when you recommend a shoe or a helmet or a component group, they're probably having more faith in you because they see that you're out there actually on the weekends using those items, right? I would imagine.
Yeah, a big part of, you know, at least in my own opinion, is that I have actual experience with using the products that I sell. I had a call from not nearby here for a customer that was looking for a CD wire shoe that would fit the Speedplay sole. They don't make it anymore. I have the shoe. It's a $500 shoe. I told the guy, do not buy it in the most distinct way possible. Because I said, well, I have the shoe and it doesn't work very well. You know, it's not the shoe itself, but the interface between the pedal and the shoe, it's not all it's cracked up to be. And, you know, it was a surprisingly long conversation to talk to somebody and say, I know that you want XYZ, but having actually used it, I don't recommend it. This is a better solution.
I feel like that customer is going to call you every time they're thinking about buying something new now. They're going to be like, Amos. I think sometimes.
Well, I think he was like halfway across the country. So I hope he doesn't call too much. But
that's the type of service, you know, that I think is critical and it really sets you apart. You know, when you're not just saying, yeah, I can get that for you, that you're actually taking an interest in helping the person become a more engaged, better cyclist and really appreciate what they buy. Yeah, and it's because you're out there and you're using the product.
Have you heard of P2 groups and wondered what they are? P2 stands for the Profitability Project. And while profitability is at the focus of everything we do so much more. P2 group members share their expertise and their insights. They ask questions and they exchange resources to make sure every member is profitable and successful in every aspect of bike shop ownership. Reach out today so we can tell you more.
I know you coach, right? And so is coaching part of the business? You know, is that part of Brumble Bikes too?
I mean, it is. I mean, now, you know, just because things have been pretty busy, and I want to say, without competitive cycling being like kind of like a thing at this point, I don't have to do that much of it anymore. Most of the stuff would be an individual would come in and they would have some questions for me. And a lot of times I'm just answering them for free. You know, it's not a financial relationship or anything like that. I mean, I will say that I've coached a number of people and those customers, their lifetime customer value is very high, really high. So, I mean, I don't live in a wealthy area. So these are, you know, people that have maybe a professional job, you know, they're teachers or they're a small business owner. They're not wealthy, but it's not unusual for them to spend $5,000 or $10,000 a year on bike stuff.
I feel like the coaching, it lets you connect on a different level, right? And it's more personable and yeah, establishing long-time customers, that's a great way to do that. Okay, but let's switch gears because yeah, I could talk to you forever. You know, let's talk about VeloTooler. For our listeners who don't know, VeloTooler is a software that connects bike brands, cyclists, and fleets with local insured bicycle mechanics and bike stores to deliver service at the consumer's home. You're the operations manager. And so what I just said was what I got off the website, but can you tell us in your words so we might understand better what VeloTooler is?
Yeah, I mean, essentially what's happening is that there's a need for a way to connect like skilled mechanics shops, mobile shops to people that need the skills. Now, the average person might go on and do a search of some kind, you know, for a bicycle shop or something like that. But a lot of times we're coming in a lot earlier in the process, you know, probably when they're buying the bike, because right away they need help, you know, and they'll say to the brand, hey, you know, I'm buying my bike and, you know, I don't have any mechanical skills or I don't want to do this. What are my options? So a lot of brands cold call shops, you know, whoever they can find to try and get the work done. VeloTooler is just looking to smooth that process out, you know, so that customers, you know, when they have a need for service, that there's a more direct way to get them there, something that's a little more automated. And I think it's not an entirely unique idea, but in the bike industry, combining everything is the real challenge.
So you're super busy. You're running a shop. And I think, 5 years ago, you became involved with VeloTooler. How did that happen?
Initially, I was brought in to help with, like, there's a quiz at the, you know, when a potential service provider is signing up, they have a 10-question kind of like randomized quiz that they have to answer. It's multiple choice. So I was brought in to add some questions to that mix. And then when we went to start filling out, you know, like a particular service, then there was like some Excel worksheets where you would describe the service, estimate how long it would take, what tools would be required, and just a few other pointers. And then a lot of the data from that was used to develop things like tool lists and, you know, approximate times and pricing for a variety of jobs.
So you were helping with like the backside of like all the mechanics and like the questions you should be asking and how to really qualify and certify the shops or mechanics that would be taking part.
Yeah. I mean, you know, for us, I mean, we want obviously people that are qualified to do the work. And ideally, we would have a lot more shops at the platform, to tell you the truth. I mean,
yeah. Well, well, Amos, I want to ask about that because we are the MBTA. Yeah. So is this good for shops? Is this a revenue booster? Is this something shops should be looking into?
My answer is yes, because I think there's a couple things that are like at play. A lot of customers that are buying direct from a brand, I always tell people those people have a few options when it comes to the mechanical part of things. And, you know, the first one is, and everybody really likes this one, they would ask for help and they would hire somebody. But I tell people they really have two other choices. They do it themselves or they don't do it at all. And, you know, my personal opinion is that the reason that we have so many bikes to fix around like in bike shops this year that people brought out of the basement is that they broke and they didn't have anybody fix it. It just sat on a hook. So yeah, I tell people, it's like, if you can provide an easy way for these people to form a relationship with, you know, somebody to provide the service, the chances are they're going to keep going there.
So I'm a bike shop owner. Like, let's say I was, right? I'm not anymore, but let's say I was. How do I get signed up? What do I have to do?
It's pretty straightforward. You know, you go to the site, which is just velotooler.com, and there's a thing where you can basically, I want to be a mechanic. In terms of like on the back end, there is probably going to be, you know, in the not too distant future, a way to say something where essentially you're a bike shop right away. It'll change the process a little bit. But when a shop signs up, they're essentially signing up, you know, as a mechanic. And the only real differences in a shop is that you are going to have one of your mechanics go. And there is a way to communicate through the app with a customer. And, you know, the only thing we'll say is, well, you know, if your mechanic John is going to go, you know, have John send them a headshot of what he looks like in his car, whatever he's going to be driving to the location in, and then communicate with the customer. All the financial stuff is going to happen to the shop directly.
Mm-hmm. I feel like when you're going to a customer's house, and I was talking about this earlier today with someone who was doing a fit on a Peloton bike. That's another way that shops are making extra revenue right now, fitting Peloton bikes. But when you're going to someone's house to either do a mechanic service or to, you know, do a fit, the relationship that you're establishing in that trust level is huge, right? Someone's letting you in their home. And yeah, it's a great opportunity to talk about, you know, other items, answer any questions. And I love that. I think I can't see why shops wouldn't get signed up to have one of their mechanics take part in Velotooler. It sounds like a no-brainer to me.
I mean, it sounds like a no-brainer. I mean, I think it's important that I've talked to a lot of shops and individual mechanics, you know, because one of the things that I do is interview mechanics. It's part of the sign-up process, you know, for Velotooler is a phone interview. And so, yeah, there's definitely going to be pushback. I think, you know, like shops are going to be concerned about how much money the job is going to bring in. One of the things I say is, you know, if it's not going to pay enough money, don't go. We don't penalize the shop or an individual mechanic if they don't go to a job that's in the work area that they have defined. Maybe they're too busy. You know, maybe it doesn't pay enough. We understand that. But, you know, if a customer needs a bike assembled, you know, and it's close enough by, or there's a fleet service that's in your neighborhood, you might really want to think hard about not doing that thing and do it instead. Just go for it.
Sounds like you're super busy, Amos, with every like day in and day out between shop operations and interviewing potential mechanics. I would love to sit in on some of those interviews, by the way. I'm sure you've had some good ones.
They're really good. You know, I think a lot of people initially, you know, there's a lot of people that are very critical of anything that Bellator has done. I think they do spend a lot of time playing devil's advocate, which I get it. I understand. A lot of people want to tell you that something's not going to work or it's not right. And I've had a lot of those conversations. Sometimes, you know, the person can maybe look at it a different way and they join the platform. And sometimes it's just, you know, it's not a good fit for them and they don't join. And, you know, that's okay.
Yeah. Okay. I'm going to switch it up on you again right now. One of the things I look forward to are your emails through Brumble Bikes. You have a blog, or I would call it maybe a newsletter more, in which I'm a subscriber. I read every one and I'm a huge fan. And once I was in the shop and I think you had told me that you can see who opens them or not. So like, I make it a point to read everyone, but the content is so great. It's clearly written by you, and I feel like you kind of adapt it to fit the needs of your business. This content that you deliver, I mean, this, it must pay dividends. So I was wondering if you could help other bike shop owners get a sense of like what you do with this and how they could create something similar. I mean, do you use a certain platform? I feel like your newsletters are once or twice a week. Like, talk to me about this.
So I started by looking for somebody that did, should probably back it up. I mean, before I opened my own store, I needed help with like sales. So I found somebody that had a cassette course, like cassette tapes in a book. And I bought that and tried to absorb the information. And then when I opened up my own store, I knew marketing was going to be important. And since I was already in that space where I was like, yeah, you know, I want to learn somebody that's doing it, I found somebody that was doing direct marketing, like, I want to say like a newsletter, you know, kind of thing that you could sign up for, like a paid monthly thing. And I signed up for that. It was Ryan Lee. He's actually in Connecticut. So he had like a couple, you know, like big seminars where he'd invite everybody in. I went to a few of those. They were really good. And, you know, I took a lot of the recommendations that I would say from somebody that's successful at using email marketing to build the business. And that meant emailing regularly. So I email like a lot.
But surprisingly, not too much, because your content is so, it's not like I'm going to open up and get the same. I mean, I always want to open it up. Maybe it's your topics, maybe it's the words that you choose to use, but it's so good that it's never too much.
Well, I mean, I think the basics are build an email list, choose a good, like, you know, subject line, that way they open it, and then content is king. So, you know, write good stuff. And then basically I give people like a call to action, like maybe, you know, every three or four emails will be something that, this is something that's here, you can buy it. Most of my emails are meant to build like top of the mind awareness, which was a big push, like in a lot of newspapers and radio advertising. And I actually have gone to some of their seminars that they were trying to push that method to you as somebody would be a potential advertiser in their product. And so I think a lot of shops and brands would be well served by being in their customers' radar, even if they don't have something to sell them. And when you have permission-based marketing, email marketing, the customer has said, I want to get information from you. And then you give it to them. And I can tell people, I have had emails where I said, blah, blah, blah. And like, people bought it that day. They drove to the store to get it. Immediately drive sales.
Yeah, your emails, it could just be about like you're going racing this weekend, or it could be like a group ride you're organizing, or it could be like, we're going to run out of trainers, get down here and buy them. Or it could be like, we have a special offer from scratch that, you know, it could be some, it's always different content, and it's you, and you're just talking as a friend, and it works. It's really engaging.
It's the style that I was, I guess, taught. It was, you know, you write like you're talking to one person that's in front of you. So that's how I write. I want to say, you know, any shop that starts this, you know, there are certainly going to be customers that are going to whip out their writing handbook and tell you that you you should have used that comment or, you know, comma here or there, or, you know, your sentence structure is like no good. And you got to get over that. You're going to get critiqued. It's just part of that kind of relationship. But I mean, you know, your writing will get better and people will get used to the style.
So are you collecting email addresses like on your website or when people come in the shop or both? How are you adding to this list?
You know, it's on the website. There's a form you can sign up. It's on my store Facebook page. And then, you know, if I talk to somebody, and especially if we're having a good conversation, you know, I'll just casually say, do you want to be on the shop email list? If they're like, yes, I'm like, great. And I take their name, just their first and last name and their email address, and put it into the system, and then basically just ask them to, you know, confirm that they want to get emails from me. And then that's it.
So I'm hearing a theme through our chat tonight. It's, you know, when you were opening your business, you sought help from a professional, you know, that when you were thinking about marketing, you went into some seminars. So it sounds like you're really an advocate of that. And would you suggest other business owners look to those avenues to help when they, you know, instead of like maybe thinking they could just do it themselves, like it seems like you got value out of those relationships that, and, you know, those things you attended.
I've always been of the mindset that I have things to learn and other people can teach me. And I'm not embarrassed to ask questions that other people might think are somewhat obvious. And so I started, like, before I opened my business, I went to SCORE, you know, which is like, you know, retired executives, to get advice on what I should do. And they were like, you know, you should have an accountant, you should have a lawyer, you should have, you know, a contact at the bank. These are critical. I said, okay. I went off and did those things. So take action, like look for people that are, you know, I had a business coach, a guy's name was Bob Hoffman. He owned a local business. I would come in at like 6:30 in the morning to sit down with him and talk about business. And I was paying him, you know, I paid these people money to help me.
But it paid off, right? I mean, it paid dividends, right? Sometimes you got to invest, right? In yourself to, yeah. Okay, so inventory is running really low right now, right? With bicycles and, you know, components, accessories. Any creative tips for bike shop owners looking to make a little extra revenue right now? Any Amos words of advice?
What I did, or what I am doing for my store, is I looked at, I mean, my store isn't necessarily based 100% on buying or selling bikes. It's an important part of the business, but if I sold zero bikes, I would make it. So I looked at like other categories that I do well in, and also categories that are likely to be out of stock. And I said, all right, well, that's where I'm going to spend the money. I mean, to tell you the truth, I probably, if I could have gotten bikes, it may have been the year that I would have invested more in that. But it was really obvious that it wasn't going to work with my business model of, I want to get the right bike for the customer in terms of the size, the model, the color, everything. And it was really obvious no brand was going to be able to do that. So I said, well, I do well with repairs. I'm going to buy service parts. A lot of people are going to be buying bikes. They ran out of helmets. I bought a lot of helmets. You know, a lot of people that get into riding are like fitness minded. So I've been investing more money in Garmin, including like the watches, like fitness watches, like, you know, fashion watches.
Those are really nice.
Yeah. I mean, I think the stuff looks good. And maybe, you know, I brought in some of the Garmin Lily watches. I wrote about it in my emails and I posted it on my Facebook page and I sold two of them.
Yeah, that is exactly. It's not just when you bring in like a new product, you can't just bring it into the shop and put it on the shelf, right? That's like bringing it full circle. Share it in an email message, take some pictures, put it on social media. And then, yeah, you are going to see a few of those move. Any other retail tips that you want to share or maybe you've gotten over the years and that you think are really good and worthwhile sharing with our listeners?
I think it pays to look at building your business like you're going to sell it. Like right from day one. So, you know, I tell people like, you know, you got to market the business, the mechanical part. But, you know, at the end of the day, what would you sell? So you're selling the business processes. You're selling your email list, your customer list. I mean, that's the value of the business. It's not the product inside, or hopefully not even the particular employees. You know, I tell people that work for me, the best thing that can happen is people come in and they don't ask for me, because they know that anybody in the store is going to give them good service and help them.
Just as good service. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So what if someone's thinking about opening up a shop? Any tips you have for someone considering getting into this industry?
That one's really hard. As much as I love the bike industry and I love my job and I think about it 24 hours a day, if somebody's going to get into it, then they're going to want to make sure that what the business can provide can give them the lifestyle that they and the people that are also stakeholders are going to be happy with. So it seems like, in my experience, in a rather large number of people in the bike industry are not the major bread earners in their family situation. So definitely would, my suggestion would be that they would want to talk over what was about to happen with anybody that was going to matter. And then also realize like, yeah, this could affect things like in their future.
It's definitely a labor of love, the bicycle industry for sure. So I love this question. So I'm going to ask you, but I'm not going to pose it, I think, in a personal way, more of a business standpoint. I talked to Rochelle about, you know, the theory that like every 5 years, right, or we might be in a different spot, or we might be stronger than we were, but and we don't even know it. It's almost like we've almost reinvent ourselves every 5 years. So like your business is 16 years, I want to say, you said 16, right? 16 years. So something in the past, like 5 years, or something you've done to make the business stronger that, you know, maybe you would never have saw at once, but looking back now, you can say like, oh, that was a monumental change. Is there anything?
Monumental change.
There's something you did that, yeah, made the business stronger that maybe at the time you didn't realize what of an impact it would have. But now looking back, you're like, wow, I'm really glad I did that because it helped the business succeed in this way.
Trying to think about any one thing. It's tough because buying the building made a massive difference. It was such a huge change, you know, but that was like 8 years ago. So I'm like, all right, well, it falls out of our window.
Oh, no, we can extend the, let's break the rules. We can extend them.
Buying the real estate was the biggest long-term like change that I can see. It's not a new idea, but getting into a position to do that was very difficult. I mean, I would tell people, it's like, yeah, you know, before I bought the building, I had no credit history at all. Nothing. I bought a car.
That's it.
Yeah, that's it. Like 2 years before I bought the building, I bought a car. That's it. It's the only, there's nothing else. So buying the real estate was incredibly difficult in that scenario. And that's what made such a huge impact, because it, a lot of times, like financially, it smooths out like how much am I going to spend? So your taxes, they don't change much. You know, your monthly payments, they don't change much. And the fact is over time, those payments are staying the same. So in relative terms, running the business keeps getting easier, at least from the financial standpoint. I mean, outside of that, the only things that I think have made like a really big impact was really just the marketing to the customers. I mean, I've been doing that for a long time, but in the last year or so, I've done a lot more in terms of like social media advertising, specifically Facebook, and then the radio. I have a long-term relationship with the radio, one of the local radio stations, and there's a definite, if I do more marketing in general, sales will go up.
Wow, I love that you talk about having a connection with your local radio station, because I know that, you know, I used to do that at my shop, and I've talked to some shop owners who are like, oh no, we see no return on that. So maybe it's geographically, but it's definitely a interesting point that you brought up. So do you advertise regularly with a one certain station then?
Yeah, I do advertise with one station pretty regularly. You know, I looked at demographics. Hey, my customers are this old, you know, like, do you have customer, you know, what's your demographic like? So that's how I picked the station. I do have another one that's a classical station that I usually advertise on just a few times a year. But I will tell you, those customers will tell you that they heard your ad.
It's nice to get that feedback, right? You see that it's working. You're hearing that it's working.
Yeah, you get the feedback.
So I was listening to you chat about how, you know, deciding to purchase the building was one of the biggest things that made a biggest difference. And I'm sure it must have been a super stressful time for you. I'm sure maybe, I mean, I'm imagining that you were, here you go, from only having purchased a car before in this level of capacity, right? Now we're buying a building and there's a lot of different things coming together. I take those moments of like, those biggest moments of growth, right? Like professionally and personally, right? I can only imagine what you were experiencing then.
Oh, you know, I like to tell everybody, I had to borrow the money to get the down payment. I mean, I look back on it, I don't know what the bank was thinking. I mean, I came like this close to just not being able to make the payments. I mean, it was so much money to actually get into the building in terms of the renovations that needed to be done, not even to make it pretty, but just to meet code, like fire codes. Part of me thinks that the bank was crazy.
Here you are, it's like 16 years later, saving the world one bike at a time. I can't even begin to imagine how many cyclists you've created, how many cyclists you've increased their journey, increased their pleasure, their experience. I mean, you're great. Amos, you're incredible. Thank you for coming and chatting with me and for sharing openly about yourself and your shop and your role with VeloTooler. You know, personally, thank you for being my friend. I love our dinners. We got to put one on the calendar. I know you're a member of the MBDA, so thank you for that too. And if our listeners want to ask you more questions or learn more about the topics we touched on tonight in this episode, is it okay if they contact you? I'm gonna give away your website. I'm sure.
My email's on there. You know, there's my phone. Some people, if they want to specifically contact me about VeloTooler, it's just amos@velotooler.com. There's the store Facebook page. You know, I'm fairly responsive there. So I'm happy to help.
Thank you, Amos.
You're welcome, Heather.
All right. So that is it. I invite you to connect with me and come on Bicycle Retail Radio and share your story like Amos did tonight with our listeners. I invite you to contribute to our Outspoken blog, become a feature on our member spotlight, or lead a webinar. If you'd like to support the show, don't forget to subscribe on Spotify or Apple Podcasts. Share your favorite episode with friends and on social media. I'll be sharing this one, Amos. Appreciate your support of the MBDA and thank you for listening. And with this, we go.
This has been Bicycle Retail Radio by the National Bicycle Dealers Association. For more information on membership and member benefits, join us at mbda.com.